You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, April 3rd, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, to discuss the Indian Supreme Court ruling, the TPP trips, and the potential for a US-EU accord, all of which have to deal with patents given to corporations, essentially giving corporations power that transcends the sovereign power of nations to create environmental, intellectual property, worker standards, laws. Professor Brooke Baker, head of the Health Global Access Project at the Northeastern School of Law, Northeastern University Law School, I should say. Also on the program today, the sequester hitting localities across the country. Monsanto getting a free pass for their products. Also, new polls out. How many of you think that President Obama is literally the Antichrist? I guess at least a significant portion of the country. Also on the program today, North Carolina wants to establish an official state religion. Don't think it's going to be Islam. But more on that as the show progresses. That's the word I'm looking for. Also, Anonymous claims to have hacked the North Korean internet or intranet. Who knows? Maybe they have. And now we're down to seven Democratic senators who are holdouts as to providing some form of marriage equality. Folks, just a reminder, on Friday night, 7:30 p.m., I will be moderating a panel at the Judson Memorial Church at 55 Washington Square South in New York City on Bradley Manning and other issues related to the government's prosecution of Bradley Manning. Joining me there will, on the panel, I should say, Brigitte Jonsdottir, an Icelandic member of parliament, Kevin Gastola, reporter from Fire Dog Lake, Alexa O'Brien, an independent journalist, Peter Hart, from FAIR. That is, again, at 55 Washington Square South. And we will, this time, Michael, put a link at majority.fm. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Professor Brooke Baker. Let me tell you something right now. This is this story out of India and what it tells us also about the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, that is being negotiated in secret right now. And also TRIPS, which is another similar so-called free trade pact. And this one that's been written about on the Huffington Post front page today. These deal with the central issues of our time in terms of unfettered corporate power and the lack of ability of people through their governments to in any way limit this corporate power. It's stunning stuff. And this is one of those things that, you know, it's a little bit weedy. It's on the back pages of the newspapers. And 5 years from now, we're going to be talking about this in the way that we talk about how NAFTA decimated not only our workforce in this country, but also our ability to write our own laws and to create standards that are important to the people of these countries. But I think it's going to dwarf NAFTA. All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor Brooke Baker. He is the head of the Health Global Access Project at the Northeastern University School of Law. Welcome to the program, Professor.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Now, let's start with this ruling by the Indian Supreme Court and how Novartis is actually... You've written extensively on Novartis's attempts, sort of a three-pronged strategy, to maintain their ability to profit off of medicines, essentially, that have gone off of patent. And let's start with this, the Indian Supreme Court decision, and then we will move into to the TPP and TRIPS and these other so-called free trade deals that are being engineered as we speak. What happened in India?
Okay, so just a little bit of background before I go directly to the Supreme Court decision.
Great.
Novartis filed for a patent on its medicine called Glivec in India and Glivec in the United States. It's a very good anti-cancer medicine that treats leukemia and substantially extends people's lives. Now, the original compound that's used in that medicine was discovered in the early 90s. And at that time, India lawfully had no patent protection on pharmaceutical products because there was no international law requiring such protection at that time. In 1995, the WTO TRIPS agreement that established new standards for international intellectual property protections actually required countries to start granting patents on in all fields of technology, including pharmaceuticals. And after that effective date, after it had tweaked that chemical compound a little bit further, Novartis filed for a patent application in India. It's that second patent, and as you have it, that's at the subject of this dispute. And basically, when India became compliant with international law, it said, we're not going to allow patents on secondary products, on slight revisions to existing chemical entities and medicines. And so because Novartis had no right when it first made its discovery, it couldn't, in a sense, get retroactive patent on something that was, you know, not allowed at the time India amended its Patent Act.
So when we talk about tweaking a medicine, it may be that the tweak can be as small as changing the way that it's absorbed by the body over what period of time, or that perhaps it's used for different ailment. What constitutes, at least in Novartis's mind, or those tweaks to constitute? I mean, in other words, where do they set the bar?
Okay, so the difference between the first discovery, which was made in the early 90s, and the subsequent discovery in a few years later at the end of the 90s, was basically the beta crystalline form of an existing chemical entity. And it's the kind of routine, let's call it product optimization, that a company goes through. It's not exactly that a trained chimpanzee could do it. I mean, I don't want to demean the lab scientist, but it's not heavy lifting as was the discovery of the original compound, which was actually discovered to have anti-cancer effects. So what they had done is tweak this just a little bit to have a particular crystalline form of a salt and then claimed a new patent on that. Well, that was not initially granted even in the U.S., but Novartis appealed and eventually won the patent on the secondary crystalline form in 2005. But India has a different standard. It has a standard that it will not evergreen or give secondary patents on minor modifications of known compounds, nor on new uses, what we call new indications for existing medicines, nor on combinations or new formulations or new dosages. Basically, they said, if you do that kind of incremental innovation, we will not patent it unless it has significant therapeutic impact in the treatment or prevention of human disease. And that's the precise issue that was before the Supreme Court of India. Novartis was basically trying to get India to adopt an easy-to-meet standard of review on secondary patents. And what India said is, the Supreme Court said is, we are against evergreening. We want generics to be able to come to the market when they're supposed to come to market. And we are not going to allow these minor modifications to get patent protection unless you meet a strict standard with respect to significant therapeutic impact.
Now Novartis
had no evidence that that its second, variation had any such impact in terms of treatment of cancer.
And so let's talk about the implications of this practice that in the U.S. is the bar is lower. I mean, because you've written that the generic competition by Indian companies has produced a 99.4% drop in the price of the lowest cost first line medicines. The figures you give are from basically $10,500 to $61 per person per year. And you write that most of the 6.6 million people living with HIV in Africa, Asia, Latin America are alive because of that steep drop in prices. And the flip side of that, of course, is that in the United States and other developing nations, these minor tweaks essentially allow the patents to continue on for years and years, crowding out, or basically not just crowding out, but essentially eliminating any type of market for generics.
Right. So you're absolutely right. So the basic scenario is when there's robust generic competition competing at efficient economies of scale, medicine prices drop fantastically. So the new, better antiretroviral medicines that are used to treat AIDS, and particularly most of the 8 million people in developing countries receiving antiretroviral therapy, is now a fraction of a penny of what the same medicine costs in the United States, and that's completely because there's no patent blocking access to those medicines, either in India where they're produced or in African countries where they're largely consumed. Now, what and so, you know, from our perspective, it's vitally important, one, that we have a lot of countries that are able to, you know, import or make on their own generic copies, but also that there's lots of generic competitors. What the U.S. and Big Pharma are pushing for, including Novartis, is a system that guarantees that they can get additional 20-year monopolies for minor modifications of existing medicines. So they'll, let's say they file their first patent in year one. In year 10, they'll file another one and get 20 years from that. And then in year 20, they'll file another and get another, you know, essentially 10 years onto their patent. So we know that there are some antiretroviral medicines in the U.S. where the effective patent monopoly is now approaching 40 years because we too easily grant patents for these kinds of minor modifications. If those rules are forced on other countries, low- and middle-income countries, their patients will be waiting for decades for affordable medicine, and people die during that time period. So this is really a matter of life and death. You mentioned earlier on the broadcast that, you know, the U.S. is seeking looser standards for patents on medicines in free trade agreements. The most important such effort right now is in something called the U.S. Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement negotiation involving 12 countries. And in that negotiation, the U.S. is directly challenging the kind of patent rule that India has in its Patent Act, which basically safeguards against evergreening. The U.S. insists, and this is direct language, that there can be patents on new forms, new uses, and new formulations of existing medicines. So basically, the easy-to-get standard that we have in the U.S. would be imposed on all those trading partners and indirectly on India and a few other countries that are adopting stricter standards.
Okay, and before we get a little bit deeper into the TPP, I want to just go over some of the myths that you write about in terms of what the implications of this ruling are, and talk about, because these myths that you debunk as Novartis comes out and says, you know, this is going to wreak havoc on our ability to develop new medicines and whatnot. I want to talk about which ones of those also apply to the U.S., because in this country, we are engaged in a period of austerity. There is being more pushes for austerity under the rubric of a debt crisis. This debt crisis, to the extent that we have a debt issue at all going forward into the future, is very much driven by healthcare costs. And the healthcare costs are very much driven in many respects by the cost of pharmaceuticals. And, right. And so this has incredible implications in a much broader context. Even when we put aside the implications of the way that the TPP is being structured, so let's go through some of the myths that are both important in terms of the developing world and people getting access to medicine there, but also the ones that deal with the myths that we hear in this country in terms of what it will do to the development of new medicines if we were to revise our patent laws in such a way that made more sense.
That's a great question. I mean, let's take developing countries first, and then the very important question of the U.S. as well. So, you know, most of the sales and most of the profits on medicines now are currently made in the rich countries of Europe, North America, and Japan. Approximately 75% of profits and over 70% of sales are actually earned in those rich country markets. And, of course, they're earned there because Big Pharma charges higher prices in those markets. Now, developing countries therefore, and, you know, India is 2% of the global market, and, you know, most poor countries are only a tiny fraction of the global market. What Big Pharma says is, well, we won't do research and development. We won't have money to do that if we can't continue to make maximum profits off every country in the world, including these countries that are very poor and a very small part of the global market. And that's basically nonsense. Big Pharma invests in research and development primarily for medicines that affect rich people in rich countries, so-called chronic disease medicines that people have to take every day, or medicines like those that treat cancer and at least extend people's lives. And the system currently does not incentivize research in what are called neglected tropical diseases, the kind of diseases like dengue fever and sleeping sickness and other diseases that afflict 1 billion people in developing countries who are too poor to really pay for medicine developed through this very expensive patent system we have. So, you know, the system doesn't give medicines for the priority needs of developing countries, and or it results in overpriced medicines that they can't afford, even for the chronic diseases for which there are incentives within the rich country markets. So, I mean, the basic economic point to get across is this decision in India or others like it in other countries will not shut down research and development on new medicines. That said, our system is currently very inefficient at producing therapeutically targeted medicines and improvements in medicines. What Big Pharma goes after are basically lifestyle diseases, baldness, impotence, you know, those kinds of conditions, which really not life and death matters. Or it tries to develop what are called me-too drugs to try to steal market share from another company that has a blockbuster for treating diabetes. So much of our research and development is essentially wasted on trying to extend patent monopolies or compete with another monopolist by grabbing a share of an existing market. And we have lots of conditions in which there's inadequate research and development. So I think the solution for the U.S., certainly one of them might be significantly tightening up patent standards and giving, you know, forcing companies to really focus on, you know, therapeutic gaps instead of me-too drugs. But, you know, some people are arguing something I think makes a lot of sense, which is we ought to have one kind of market for innovation and another market for access. We ought to have grants and prizes to reward and incentivize researchers to make therapeutically important discoveries. And there ought to be people who make contributions along the way, and everything doesn't go to the winner through a monopoly. And then we ought to let those resulting discoveries be produced and sold near the cost of production by, you know, good quality generic producers. There would be tremendous savings in our health system if we stop Pharma from making, you know, huge profit rates and spend 2.5 times more on marketing and administration than they do in research and development. They take home more in profits than they spend in research and development, even after they paid for research and development. We have a system which is bloated that doesn't give us returns on the research and development made, and waste a lot of money that could otherwise be saved, both in funding R&D and in paying for the resulting discoveries.
All right, Professor, let's just unpack this, because I want to really be clear with this, because this is so on one hand, we see that developing countries, which suffer from diseases that developed countries don't suffer, they don't get the type of research development dollars because there's not the market incentive for these companies to develop those things. And so the idea that you're talking about these two different markets, to make this a little bit more digestible for us, just walk us through this. So there would be a system set up that would be ostensibly funded by governments that would target the development of drugs for based upon the needs that exist with human disease, as opposed to the the requirements or I guess the incentives that a marketplace would. In other words, you use dengue fever, it's not as profitable to develop something for dengue fever because there are people in this country who really want a full head of hair, and they're willing to pay, and they have the capacity to pay more for it than those people who are suffering from dengue fever.
Right. So you're right. There really are two issues. There's one that there's totally neglected research areas. We actually have a neglected research area in antibiotics now because people only take them for 10 days. Most of the major drug companies are dropped out of creating new antibiotic medicines because they don't think they'll make enough money. And suddenly we're in a position where hospitals have untreatable bacterial infections. So our system doesn't produce medicines according to therapeutic need. They produce medicines by what will give them the most monopoly profits that they try to extend by getting evergreen patents, et cetera.
And so let me just stop you there. So this process, by lowering the bar for new patents or patents to be essentially extended, we're actually disincentivizing companies from doing research into areas which would provide us with better health.
Absolutely. For us domestically and certainly globally in terms of neglected diseases, there's a lots of improvements to medicines that we would still want. But the question is whether you're going to give a 20-year monopoly and allow a company to charge whatever the market will bear to get it. The new cancer medicines and what they're calling individualized medicine, they want $100,000 or $200,000 a year for those treatments. You're right in what you said earlier. Our country can't afford that. Our government can't afford it, especially in an era of austerity, and especially when U.S. workers, still need to compete to some extent on global markets, and the costs of their health care are so exorbitant. So, we have a ton of wastage in our system, particularly with respect to medicines, but in other medical expenses as well. And there's a solution. We could say, well, instead of giving exclusive rights and the right to monopoly profits that restricts access to poor people, both domestically and globally, who can't afford them, why don't we, take some of the savings we'd give from not having that monopoly system, pour it into research and development, focus on neglected diseases, focus on antibiotics, focus on preventive medicines, including vaccines, focus on, areas where we don't yet have medicines, and why don't we really get the medicines we need from the scientists who are capable of doing it, but then assure that people who need the medicines and the governments to pay for it can afford it? Our system now really doesn't do either task very well.
And so, not to put too fine a point on it, but if we were to shrink or to raise the bar on extending these patents, or even to shrink the term of patents, what it would do is you'd still have these pharmaceutical companies making profits, but they would also seek profits in other areas that are underserved right now, because it would almost sort of level the playing field and keep the playing field from spiking in certain areas that are simply inefficient.
Right. I think there'd be a big difference. You'd have a whole bunch of research scientists working in different kinds of organizations, lots of them the small ones that are currently exist. You'd have a method for doing the last stage research and development, the clinical trials to make sure the medicine is safe and effective and of good quality. Once that was determined, then you'd have another whole industry that would basically produce and sell. What you get rid of are these bloated big pharma companies that are mainly about marketing, mainly about sending sales reps out to talk to every doctor in the world. And, a huge waste of resources, both in trying to extend their patent monopolies and on trying to, get a sales advantage by pestering doctors and putting ads on TV during news broadcasts. So, we need a new system. But I want to kind of go back to the point that we started with, which is the crisis in developing countries is much more severe even in the U.S. And Big Pharma and the U.S. government through the U.S. Trade Representative are seeking to impose longer, stronger, and broader patent monopolies on medicines in every country in the world, including our own. And we have to fight back. The activists in India and an international coalition of treatment activists, particularly AIDS activists, of which I'm a member, have fought for years to support India in adopting strict standards of patentability, and then to protect their use. And, you know, we are under threat because Big Pharma, Novartis, and the U.S. government continue to try to secure monopoly protections that will hurt patient access to life-saving medicine.
And the argument that someone would make, well, if you diminish the profits in any fashion for these companies, they will not discover these new drugs. We will not push the boundaries.
They will have some less money from poor countries, but poor countries aren't the place they make most of their money. Now, they are hoping to make more money, and the projections are they will continue to make increasing amounts of new profits in what are called farm emerging countries like China and Brazil and India, the kind of big middle income countries. That's where a lot of their growth comes in the future. But what I'm also saying is that the current system is nuts. We are wasting so much money to protect this bloated monopoly-based system, and we could get better research for less money, producing better medicines, if we dropped the monopoly system and went to a different kind of incentive system. Now, we have to have some, you know, the U.S. Constitution is actually a bit of a problem in the U.S. We're supposed to have some period, of protection for copyright and patents. But internationally, the big problem is this, TRIPS agreement that was passed under WTO with the assistance of the U.S. IP industries. But the world has to come to a better accommodation. The U.S. has to be a part of that accommodation to say medicines are a global public good. We cannot treat them like we're treating bicycles. We may want to give monopolies on bicycle parts and inventions, but we shouldn't do it for medicines. And it will be possible to come up with a system whereby inventors and give up what are otherwise patent rights for basically prizes and grants. And the resulting discoveries will be more widely available at a much more affordable price.
And when we talk about the constraint on some type of reform in this country, because the Constitution calls for patents to ensure that we have some type of we have incentives to invent new medicines. But really what we're talking about in this country at this point is well beyond that. We're talking about a tremendous amount of patent abuse.
Beyond the constitutional minimum, believe me. We are light years beyond what was thought. And, what we discover is our research and development isn't very efficient. And in some sectors, the patent system is actually getting in the way. We hear about patent trolls, we hear about patent thickets, we hear about patents on research platforms.
On podcasts,
patents on genes. I mean, things that, make no sense whatsoever and actually get in the way of ongoing innovation.
Let's talk about the you've written about the TPP, which is a trade agreement that the United States is engineering right now with, I believe it's about 12 other countries in the Pacific Rim. And we know only a little about this agreement because it's being done in secrecy. Some chapters of this agreement were leaked about 6 to 8 months ago, I believe it was. And provide for us the analogy, what you know in terms of what it does for IP, for patents, in terms of pharmaceuticals, but give us a more universal view of what these trade agreements do. There was a report today in the Huffington Post about the attempts for the Obama administration to create a similar agreement with the EU. What does this effectively do? Because when we talk about, and I should just say this, when we talk about, and the analogy holds whether it's a developing country or a developed country, we are talking about the will of the people as manifested through their government, to create standards which provide for a better functioning society, whether that is allowing for more medicines for more people to address the specific needs of that population, whether it's environmental concerns, whether it's worker safety concerns. And all of these manifestations of the will of the people will be trumped by corporations' will to profit through these trade agreements.
Right. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, the much more bird's eye view of these agreements is they are efforts to strengthen transnational corporate power, full stop. If you needed one sentence, that's what they're about. They talk about them being about jobs. They talk about it being, you know, leveling the field for international trade. But when you look at the details, what they're really trying to do consistently is to make it easier for corporations to get cheap labor and to sell their products in other countries and to make high profits. Now, with respect to IP, the U.S. has what we call comparative advantage in IP-protected industries, in film and movies and in music and in pharmaceuticals and in software, not so much in publishing. And so all these monopoly systems, patents, copyright, trademark, are really systems that are designed to make sure that existing transnational corporate power gets more profit in its pocket. And trade agreements basically grease that process.
Talk about Eli Lilly in the context of NAFTA, because I think this is illustrative of what kind of power it gives these corporations relative to sovereign nations. And, I mean, it really is in some way, it really comes down to, it seems to me, and maybe I'm overstating this, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it is essentially putting corporate will to profit, it transcending sovereign nations' ability to structure their society.
Oh, absolutely. So, I mean, one thing in terms of background is, in addition to trying to get stronger substantive rules for intellectual property protections, the U.S. is also seeking enhanced enforcement powers and measures that mean that not only can private right holders, big pharma, sue a competing generic company that gets in their way, but they get the state to act on their behalf by seizing products at the border. They get criminal procedures initiated. And now in what we call investment chapters, they actually allow companies to directly sue sovereign states when sovereign states regulate, et cetera. So the case you mentioned was Eli Lilly. And Eli Lilly had a patent that was granted, which was later invalidated in an infringement suit that Eli Lilly had filed against Teva. And basically, the Canadian court said, this isn't a good patent. We're invalidating it. Well, Eli Lilly said, well, we were hoping to make a lot of money from that. So we're going to use this investment chapter in NAFTA to directly sue the government of Canada for $1 million for using a well-established rule of patentability to invalidate a wrongly granted patent. And, you know, despite what the courts of Canada say, they're going to go now to a panel of three private arbitrators, a kind of revolving door of, you know, international trade lawyers, a very small number of them, who act for companies in one day and then act as arbitrators the next day. And three of these guys are going to be sitting in, you know, essentially private arbitrations and deciding whether the Canadian taxpayers are going to have to give $100 million to Eli Lilly so that it makes this level of profit it wanted to. And basically, this kind of power freezes government's ability to regulate in the public interest. These kind of cases have been brought in environmental cases and consumer protection cases and mining cases and water cases, every kind of case you can think of that is actually protecting the public interest and protecting people from excesses of corporate power.
And this is what we're going to see in the TPP. If I am a corporation that you know sat that my my executive sat in a conference room and said, you know, if we can get into country X, we can anticipate $100 million worth of profits over the course of the first 10 years. And if country X says, no, actually, we have environmental standards. We have decided that your product, we have determined your product is not healthy for our people, or it will poison our air, or that it's it doesn't do what you say it does, or your patent is invalid. This corporation can then go to what you're talking about, this private arbitration panel set up of their own corporate lawyers, more or less, and get that $100 million.
Yeah, it's shocking. And you know, in the U.S. we tend to think, well, that only happens in banana republics. You know, that's when the court systems aren't fair. This is a suit against Canada, which no one thinks is a banana republic. And by the way, the same kinds of cases can actually be brought against the United States by foreign corporations. So, for example, just last 2 weeks ago, the Supreme Court in the United States issued a ruling that said that you can import a textbook from, you know, produced by a publisher that's been sold in another country back into the United States so that, you know, our college students can get cheaper textbooks. That frustrates the profit expectations of that publisher. Under investment clauses, that investor, if it were a foreign investor, could actually bring the United States government to private arbitration as well. So we all often talk about the U.S. backing up and supporting corporate power, but sometimes and many times it does so directly against the interests of U.S. taxpayers and U.S. consumers. And so, you know, the depth of capitulation to corporate power is simply stunning. And it doesn't just hurt people elsewhere. It hurts us directly here.
And one of the really dangerous, aspects of this TPP is that it would be it would have a docking provision. In other words, the agreement would exist. Other countries could join, but they would have to there would be no renegotiation. And essentially, right. I mean, you know, today there was a poll came out about how many people in this country believe in a one world government. What we're really looking at is a sort of a one world corporate, almost a parallel legal system in some respects.
Yeah. I mean, it's ironic. I mean, you know, lots of times people in the U.S. are think they're against the UN system, which actually exerts virtually no true international power. And yet, you know, our government is complicit with the creation of what you're essentially describing, which is, you know, international corporate power untrammeled. And so, you know, the vulnerability we have as, you know, civil society and, you know, regular folks is constantly under threat because we allow our government, or our government is bought and paid for, to continue to instantiate corporate power. And, I'm an AIDS activist. I'm mainly interested in access to medicines, but I've always seen the issue in the context of globalization, neoliberal policies, and the continued rise and expansion of corporate power. They are corporate powers are the puppet masters for U.S. government policy, both domestically and internationally. Well, and we have to gain some control back, living standards are going to continue to plummet, and tax revenues from corporations will continue to go down, and our health system will get worse and worse.
Professor Brooke Baker from the Health Global Access Project at the Northeastern University Law School, thank you so much for joining us today. And people have got to keep an eye out for this TPP. Do you have any sense of when this may emerge from the shadows? I mean, because it is.
Well, it's in a, you know, it gets mentioned every now and then. As you said before, it is called by the Obama administration the new global standard as a 21st century agreement. Well, boy, if that's true, we're in real trouble.
Yeah.
And so people need to find out more about it. They need to start putting some pressure on their members of Congress to say, we want to have hearings about it. We want to know what it says. We don't want to negotiate in secret. We don't want what's called trade promotion authority, which means you have to vote only up and down. We want to actually have you take a serious look at what's in there. And
that's otherwise known as fast track, right? I mean, that's
otherwise known as fast track. I mean, you know, the Republicans are pretty much lining up that they'll stamp anything that's in favor of corporations, and the Democrats aren't much better. But, you know, people in the United States, and especially to the extent we take into account the interests of our brothers and sisters overseas, we've got to oppose these kind of agreements that are going to become the template for the next century.
Where can people find more information at this time?
Well, Public Citizens has a lot of information on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement in particular, so I would recommend that people go there.
All right.
But also the AFL-CIO is doing work on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. There's more, you know, kind of focused attention on these issues by some people who work on copyright, and certainly people who work on medicines as well.
Professor, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it, and hope to speak to you again.
Okay.
I mean, maybe, hopefully the circumstance will be, boy, we dodged a big bullet there.
Yeah, I hope so.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, folks. Ooh, went long. All right, ladies and gentlemen. It is that time of the program where I tell you that we're going to head into the better half, and we will be talking about how North Carolina wants to start a new state religion, an official state religion. And we will talk about the DFA's, Howard Dean's organization, targeting state legislatures, presumably in a 5 or 6 year plan, getting ready for that 2020 census and redistricting. Also, we will talk about that poll on conspiracies. Folks, I'm sure that there are many other podcasts out there, programs where you could listen to someone discuss the implications of this Indian Supreme Court ruling and the TPP and the WTO. And by all means, I hope that you support them. But if you cannot find such a podcast, please support this one. You can become a member today at majority.fm. It is your membership that supports this show. Right about now, I would say we're about 99.7% of our capacity to do this show is a function of our members. And if you can afford to join, please do so. If you can't, then you know, send me an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com if you want access to the better half. I want to read this email, or this IM I got last yesterday. I should also say the number is 646-257-3920. And if some libertarian wants to call in and tell me how we don't need regulations, societies don't need regulations because, of course, corporations will just do the right thing, and the markets will sort it out. We live in a world, in a country where essentially, you know, we have cheap access to capacity to grow hair on our heads, but not necessarily other medications.
Do we have a special line for those libertarians?
We have a special line for libertarians we're going to open up. It's 646-257, and that's 3,920. I want to read this from a listener yesterday. My sister and I are longtime listeners from the first Air America days. She's in Michigan, and I'm in New York City. We listen live together every day and text each other. My sister got me a Majority Reporter membership for Christmas. I tell her almost every day that it's the best gift ever. For that one members-only show last week that she was really disappointed that she couldn't hear it, I didn't realize that she didn't have a membership, so I got her one right then. I know you have a lot to do now that you're back, but could you please send me your password soon? Because she's starting not to believe I got it for her. Yes, folks, if you're going to buy a gift membership, and it makes a wonderful gift, there's nothing better than a happy spring gift of a Majority Report membership. Just send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Before you sign up, tell us what your name is and who you want it to go to and what their email address is. We will take care of you for that, or take care of that for you, I should say. Number 646-257-3920, the IM, Majority FM. See you on the better half.
Say it's in a good place.